Hey there, welcome to another episode of Dead Frog Podcast. I am your host, Joe Felix. This is a podcast dedicated to analyzing, understanding, and pretty much trying to learn what stand-up comedy is all about. Today, I don't have my co-host, Allie Closter, with me. She is currently, working with Fever, a team at the PAC Theater. They're working on some sketches. Please do go and support the PAC Theater. It's a great institution. Right now, they have a lot of Twitch shows going on, and Allie and her team are great in it. Next, today we're going to talk about Dana Gould. Dana Gould's a fantastic and prolific comedian. We're going to talk about his 1992 One Night Stand special. He, if you know much about Dana Gould, he began performing on stage at age 17. He wrote for the Ben Stiller Show. He wrote for The Simpsons from 2001 to 2007. And then he was, I think, co-executive producer from 2002 to 2007. And, like, since then, he's, I think, gone to do some voice work there and contributed in other ways. My most favorite, most recent and favorite role for Dana Gould has been when he plays the grave digger at On Stand Against Evil. And with me today to talk about him is James Hilmer. James Hilmer is the host of Don't Sit in the Front. It's a newly baptized podcast. It's dedicated to talking about stand-up. James Hilmer is my first guest who is a non-comedian, which I think is really cool because why limit your circle of the sort of criticisms you hear and or discussions about comedy to just performers. And I think James is a really, smart dude. I think he paid attention. I think he understands comedy. And right now you'll hear him talk and he'll tell you a little bit more about his podcast. Please welcome to the pod, James Hilmer.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me. Thanks so much for making time and flattering me a little bit. I hope I can bring something to your discussion of stand-up. Maybe other comics will hear this and be either interested or just annoyed to hear what a fan has to hear. But I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Of course, I'll give you my time. Time is all we have, right? And I don't think you need to worry about contributing or like being great with your insight or like worrying that other people might not value your insight, because what matters right now is you and me talking about Dana Gould. But before we talk about that, can we talk about Don't Sit in the Front, which has featured some of our guests, Gadi Assad and Lexi Grace, who is one of my favorite people in comedy right now?
Yeah. I started a podcast I had called Don't Sit in the Front. I'm kind of circling around the idea of why I love stand-up, why others might love it. I originally had the idea to have it be more fans, but then I realized with the pandemic starting and wanting to get it off the ground, the more I asked and talked to comics, they have a lot of free time right now. They also just want to talk to fans of stand-up and really break it down too, because so many comics are also fans of stand-up. So I had the idea for a while, and then was just really so bored and sad not getting to see stand-up while we've been in various stages of the lockdown. So I started the podcast about 2 months ago, and it's been going really well. And then at some point in that process, I realized there's another podcast called Dead Frog, and we had some of the same guests, and we're kind of circling around the same sort of energy, kind of nerding out about stand-up. Really breaking it down, looking at what it is that we like about this art form. And I think now is an interesting moment to look at it, both fans and people who perform, just because it's been on pause for so long. It's still here in different iterations online, people still making podcasts, doing Zoom shows, also some outdoor shows, what have you. But yeah, I just miss seeing it so much in LA that I want to talk to people about it again. And that was the idea for the podcast.
That's I think that's exactly what it is. I think there's a way in which it's very clear that you do miss stand up, and I'm right there with you. It's like super important. Other than watching like the great stand up that's in Los Angeles, I hate that I can't perform.
Mm.
I like telling jokes, even if it is to like a group of five or six people.
Mm-hmm.
I like doing that in person. And so I mean, in doing you have about 10 episodes.
Yeah, this week will be the 10th. Talking to Chelsea Quinn. She was a show producer. I think she worked on Women Crush Wednesdays. Other guests I've had. I talked to Sam Talent about his book Running the Light. I talked to Joe here from Dead Frog. That episode will come out in a few weeks. So this week will be week 10.
Hey, I'm happy. Like, thanks for sharing who we're gonna like listen to in the near future. I think it's always like a nice piece of insight to have. I think it's just like really cool secret knowledge. Hey, it's like going to a movie preview. It's like, yeah, I know. I'm a little cooler than you now that I know these things.
Yeah. You've seen the A24 trailer because you went to the premiere rather than seeing it on YouTube a little bit later. Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it. Women Crush Wednesdays, real quick. That's with Marcella Arguello.
Yeah. The guest I have this week, Chelsea, she was doing producing and booking on that. Broke LA's comedy stage. But she kind of went on pause right before the whole world went on pause with her stand-up production. So the whole world kind of paused on their stand-up production. So, she's who I talked to for this week's episode. And I've just been kind of banking episodes. And, you know, something that some of the comics told me was, you know, you might have trouble getting some people on your podcast, but a lot of comics are like, they rarely hear from a fan with this kind of approach. So I ask every guest the same set of questions about their personal relationship to stand up. You know, what's their earliest memory of liking stand up? And people have very different responses. You know, people are in stand up for very different reasons. Some people are coming at it as a means to get to something else. Which is, you know, that's fine too. But some people are really in it just to do the act of stand up, and they have, you know, very different histories with it. And yeah, then I've also, it kind of morphed too during the pandemic to talk about how people are surviving and what they're doing with their stand up as they have to take it online or in these other non-traditional ways of doing it. So I think it will be. Hopefully it gets to the point where I do it in person, but it's going to be a weird kind of historical document to look at, you know, all these Zoom calls with comics that are kind of stuck in their different places around the country, talking about what it's been like in their particular city with how stand-up got shut down and then how they're trying to bring it back.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's a very interesting thing to think about. Cause I don't know if you know Chris Lupe Estrada, who was a guest on my podcast. Mm. He is, I think, in the Netherlands, and they're hosting live comedy because they weren't hit with the pandemic as hard. Like, they were able to manage it very well. But they're doing live comedy over there. I think that he might be someone worth talking
to. Oh, yeah,
but,
cool.
How would you summarize your experience in talking to stand-ups? So far, have they answered, other than the questions that you ask most of your guests, have they answered questions that you've sort of had that maybe were like that were more esoteric or nuanced?
Yeah.
Is there like
a, I think something that's been interesting is seeing how being just a fan, I'm sort of a blank slate for how that person, that comic, wants to talk about their relationship and kind of the politics and the different comedy scenes they're in, because I'm not invested. So that for some people, they kind of like, you know, there's like these different issues, like right before stand-up went kind of on pause, there were all these issues about kind of like the Civil War in comedy, or there's all these longstanding things of like PC, more like PC kind of comics versus people think they're like free speech warriors or whatever, or like alt comedy versus club comedy. All of those things kind of come out. I skew more towards alt comedy in my fandom, but also just in who I have access to and who I'm going to talk to also kind of skews that way. But there's some people that are kind of like sort of defending club comedy, making me see it in different ways than I would have had I not started the podcast. And also just people having very different ideas about whether it's going to come back, how it's going to come back. People being very, very negative. I think some people I talk to, they almost, my asking them, what do you think will happen with comedy or that kind of question? For some of them, surprisingly, it seems like it's the first time they've really truly thought about it. And they kind of enter in like a existential crisis on microphone for me. So I had one where I kind of edited around stuff like that. I'll never tell who, but it was just sort of, it was just, it was like awkward for me too. It's just interesting that, and I don't input a lot. This is probably the most I'll talk. I'm a guest on your podcast, so I'll input a lot more, but I'm a lot more of just asking questions and clarifying questions on my podcast and kind of letting comics talk because they like to. And they will tell me all kinds of things. And that, like I said, just their different politics on what was happening in comedy before the pandemic kind of come out in different ways. But it's frustrating because we can't do anything about like, should we run shows? Should they run shows this way? Should they get lineups that are more inclusive? Should they do all these kind of things? Those are kind of on pause and only really mediated by Zoom shows right now. And then which comedy clubs are inviting people back? Are they inviting back abusers and rapists and that kind of thing? All those kind of politics come out in these more in-depth conversations. So I hope people are interested in it. I haven't made it sound very funny or enjoyable, but I think it is. And we do have interesting conversations. So I hope people will check it out. Don't sit on the front. Don't sit in the front. And it's Don't Sit in the Front on Instagram. We're on Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all that good stuff.
Cool. Wow. You really are better with words than I am here. I do have one final question before we move on to the clip. As an audience member, as someone who appreciates stand-up, and you've been in Los Angeles for about a decade now, is there anything you'd want to see play out differently or change in Los Angeles comedy?
You know, I think what the real bummer is, among the many things, you know, varying from very serious to this is just my little personal bummer, is like, well, the bummer is about stand-up getting hit so hard by the pandemic is just, I think I had really found the rooms I liked right before all of this hit. And I think the other thing, so to see how things would be different, I can't really say. I think things were going in direction, and maybe I'm naive, it's just my perspective. I think things were going in direction to be a lot more inclusive, diverse, very interesting lineups. Some shows that were like all women or four women, there were like Latinx shows. There was a really interesting show called Tasteful here in Koreatown with Jack Knight and Langston Kerman. That had a lot of black comics, but kind of on like a alt black comedy. It was like an alt black comedy room that they were cultivating. I thought that was really interesting. And then this, I maybe would have dipped my toes more into club comedy, but I really don't know how those are going to weather the pandemic and how it's going to go. So I really thought things were going in a direction, like what I did want to see was happening. And now we're just kind of waiting for it to come back.
Yeah, I do think about these shows quite a bit. I think about all these people who have had like either a show that was ongoing, like Faded, that like which we sort of talk about in the episode where I guest on your podcast. We talk about our appreciation for Faded. Like, I want that to continue. And I know they've made an effort to stay available through their online shows. But yeah, but I think about all these other shows of like, you know, people making the effort, get buying the equipment, trying to convince people to give them the time to use the space. And it like, yeah, it's sad that it's probably not going to be there after, because it's such a, people are so like, what's the word? Concerned about, well, and I think it's rightful, but like some of these businesses are businesses that were allowing stand-up to occur there, whether in their parking lot or in after-hours situations. And now it's like, yeah, we can't really lend you the space because we're in trouble. Right?
I think it'll be a long time before that kind of, like, just the example I gave, which I thought was a really good setup, but it sometimes conflicted with the business that was trying to run was just Tasteful was in that place in Koreatown that had like alcohol infused ice cream and stuff, and is more of a dessert place. I, you know, it brought in so many more people than they would normally have on like a Wednesday night or whatever it was. But first of all, getting the businesses open again to be able to have more than a few people in the store at the time, and then everybody feeling safe to go out to a comedy show with vaccines and all that, that's going to take a long time. But the thing I hope, I get, you asked what I wanted to see. I think once it's legal and possible, and some people have dipped their toes in it, is to do more outdoor stuff. Because we have the luxury in LA, except for maybe a month of the year where it's kind of too cold, we can do outdoor shows all the time.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's good. There's, we can't have that symbiotic relationship between stand-up shows and these small businesses. You know what I saw was as a positive real quick. You know, at some point there are too many open mics. And I think I heard about, I saw clips from people doing stand-up on the metro. And I think that's the fucking worst. Yeah, I cursed my podcast. Yeah. I think it's the worst. You're trying to go to work. You're coming back from work. You're tired and you have some dumb fudge, you know, talking about their wiener in front of you, and you're like, I gotta move carts now.
Yeah, me, that just seems like the setup of like a video that's gonna be on like the public freakout subreddit or something. Like, I would just be worried that person doesn't actually have sanction to be speaking to this crowd. If somebody starts speaking loudly in the subway car, I tend to move to the next one or whatever.
Yeah. I think, you know, I think we've all like, we like you here. Everyone listening in right now, if they've reached this point, they like you. They want to hear what you have to say about comedy. And before we do that, we're going to take a break, one, to listen to the clip, but also to hear a word from our sponsors. So we'll be right back.
Thank you very much. And what a handsome group you are. Everybody doing? Thanks for coming down tonight. My name is Dana Gould, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself. I'm in a lot of pain. This has been a really bizarre year for me. I just went through this one period where I was just horribly, bleakly depressed. I guess depressed is the right word. You know you're in trouble when your first words every morning are, "Oh, fuck, I'm awake." Now what? Oh, the sun and the rest of the day? Oh, pile it on. No, take your best shot. I knew I was in trouble when my mood ring exploded. I should explain what happened. It happened for a reason. For about, the past 4 years, I've been living with this woman. We'll call her Anne. And just before Thanksgiving last year, she moved out and we broke up. And for the first time in my life, I just, fine. She's an adult. She's made a decision. I cannot change her mind, nor can I live her life. Best of luck. Go on in your direction. I am just going to move on in a different direction, and we'll just be fine. We'll have what we had, and I'm not going to embrace the pain. I'm just going to move on, and that'll be it. And I felt like that for like an hour and 20 minutes. And then It was like a roller coaster. Everything's going to be wandering around my apartment with a black hood and a candle. That was Thanksgiving. But 4 days before Christmas, I come home. There's this message on my answering machine. Boop. Hi, it's me. Just calling to wish you a Merry Christmas, and I'll talk to you after the holiday. Boop. Well, that's nice. I mean, it's nice that you can have a relationship and it can just fall apart and you can still stay in touch and not become obsessed. I'm not going to erase it right away. I'll just leave it on. It's not like I'm going to play it all the time. Oh, maybe just one. Hi, it's me. Just calling to wish you a Merry Christmas and I'll talk to you after the holiday. Boop. Yeah, that's... The hell was she really trying to say? Hi, it's me. Just calling to wish you a Merry Christmas, and I'll talk to you after the holiday. Boop. Within an hour, I played it like 500 times. Slowed it down, rewind it back, play, you know, analyzing it like the Zapruder film. Hi, it's me. Hi, it's me. Hi, it's me. Holiday, 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 holiday. Sorry. I actually had a makeshift lab in the basement, teams of scientists analyzing the tape. Her voice goes up on high, it's me. That indicates she's sleeping with a big guy named Tony.
Oh, damn, dude.
Well, I don't know about that.
Woo! Dana Gould. Great stuff. James, thanks for bringing that clip to my attention. I had never seen it before, and I gotta say, even though I've been a fan of Dana Gould, I had not listened to that comedy. So can you tell us why you chose
him? So first of all, why I chose that clip in particular is just one of the things I noticed with HBO Max when I signed up for it was just that they have all of their old stand-up specials, which gives you such a catalog, but then also these series too. So that One Night Stand, I watched a few on there one night. Dana Gould was on there. There's an old Bill Hicks set, Colin Quinn, and it's just like interesting to see as a time capsule for those comics. But then Dana Gould in particular, because I knew intellectually that he'd been doing comedy for so long, but to see that special and him at that stage in the early 90s, kind of coming off of the 80s comedy boom, was just like an interesting way to look at it. And I hadn't, you know, I didn't know I could find anything that old of him. But I first learned about Dana Gould from the Comedians of Comedy Live at the Troubadour DVD, which I rented probably in high school. And he has a set on there. And I just remember being blown away. And that was kind of my first introduction to that kind of alt comedy and that group of alt comedians. Like, and then like with some, you know, we can kind of mess with that category a little bit. What is alt comedy? But specifically with him, as I kind of followed up more on it, and then over the last 15 years or so have been seeing him in LA and stuff, or the last 10 years in LA, but then just kind of following up with him and seeing his comedy, seeing him in LA. When you look at books, say like Cliff Nesteroff has a book, it's kind of like the history of comedy. It has a long name I can't think of right now, but it's kind of like the go-to book. It's called like Thieves, Scoundrels, and Scumbags, something like that. He's quoted in there a lot when they talk about alt comedy. And like the some of these spaces in Los Angeles, on cabaret, stuff like that, when people started coming up on stage with notepads, stuff like that. So he's quoted all the time when you talk about what is alt comedy. And then I got to think of where I was going with that. The next step is just like with Dana Gould. When I moved out here and I started trying to go to some comedy shows, Dana Gould had a show at the Meltdown called Tinkle Twins with Arden Marin, And occasionally his co-host would be Eddie Pepitone. And that was just a really great show just for pure stand-up. He would do like a long monologue up top. Or if it was like him and Arden or him and Eddie Pepitone, they would, you know, just talk up front, riff back and forth. And I realized like I knew his voice and the kind of references he was making. He's very referential and big into 60s pop culture. And I could feel this kind of familiarity with it. And then I realized that, you know, he had written so many seasons on the Simpsons. And the interesting thing about his Simpsons career is he wrote on the seasons that are very divisive. So he wrote on the seasons where people say it fundamentally changed. And a lot of people say they don't like after like season 7 or something. He wrote on the seasons of The Simpsons that are right in the wheelhouse of when I was in middle school and high school. So that's kind of like my era of Simpsons. So his kind of style and writing and stuff, very referential, very postmodern. All kinds of references to 60s, 70s pop culture and public figures, kind of some intellectual references. I find all that very funny. Some people don't, but like that is exactly why I like Dana Gould.
Yeah. Real quick, thank you for giving such a detailed answer. Real quick, if you're going to have a series that runs for so many years, of course you're going to have a period where, you know, you draw from pop culture and you become, what's the word, a little bit more careful with your subject matter. And by careful, I don't mean like sensitive. I mean like it becomes pointed. There's an important vehicle that you're trying to operate, and you do it. And Dana Gould, as you can tell from this clip, is willing to go into areas that are like much less.
Tread upon something. I was just thinking that the same kind of wording, because it's 1992 in that clip, and he is talking about depression, which he kind of at the very start, he is almost embarrassed. I'm sure, you know, it's planned, but he kind of doubles back and is like, well, I guess you can call it, you can say I was depressed. And the crowd just sort of has an uncomfortable laugh just at that premise. Because I think, and I could be wrong, but I think in 1992, it's not the same as today where that's a general thing that many people would say. Any young person is going to say they're depressed. Yeah. And then you'll pretty much accept it as acceptable and truth, because it's sort of just the general zeitgeist right now. But I wonder if that was still kind of a touchy thing to say and admit in the early 90s. Obviously, comics are the people that are going to say that and talk about their addictions and other things like that. But that just kind of stuck out to me. And I wanted to choose that clip because one thing in that whole set, it's the least visual. There is a visual component to it when he's kind of pretending to rewind the answering machine tape. But the rest of the set, as I looked at it, I was like, that's not going to make sense on the podcast, because he does a lot of act outs and faces and things, which now, like his last few albums, and if he were performing recently, that's not so much the case. But yeah, a lot of facial expressions, a lot of visual things go with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've already started touching on sort of the context in which he delivers his first two lines. So let's get into it. So the context is, I feel like theirs is like this wholesomeness of like the general American audience that's being shaken off. Like, even you might think that even after people like Red Fox or Richard Pryor or George Carlin, even though they've sort of picked at the fabric of society and shown you the absurdities of what it is, there's a way in which they depend on the wholesome to sort of juxtapose, to like, okay, so this is what, you know, it's obviously observational, this is what life is like. Let me just be clear about these experiences. Sorry, my dog's crying for no reason. Let me be clear about these experiences, and then you still kind of remain with a wholesomeness in the U.S. And, you know, but mental health isn't really touched on. We don't talk about how sad we can become and how long that lingers. So, and you start to have comics who are what I call like Showtime comics become more abundant, which are people who are going to give you a good time. They're high energy. They're external, right? They're like, this is a thing that you can relate to, right? It's observational. So we've both seen this, or if you haven't, this is a thing. But Dana Gould comes in and he talks about this thing we didn't want to talk about at the time, which was ourselves and those dark moments. And the thing is, he does something very carefully thought out, which is, I'm going to be silly, but also kind of dwell in this realm of melancholy and like understanding of the self. You've just heard like several times where he tells you what the mature response to a situation should be, but then it's very clear that we sometimes choose not to pursue that.
What's interesting too is you said the word wholesome. It's like when I first watched the clip, I was like, I wonder how different Dana Gould's comedy was in 1992 from present, where he's like pretty edgy, talks a lot about darker things. There's a lot of politics in what he does now. But then at first I was like, this is kind of like Brian Regan, like with the facial expressions and stuff and kind of like a silly voice. But then I realized, you know, he's talking about mental illness. He's talking about all the like unhealthy urges people give into, like when they're broken up with or something. And then he says the Zapruder film. So he's like a reference to the JFK assassination, which then put me right back in. All right, this is definitely Dana Gould, because he's always talking about like JFK and Black Dahlia murder and like stuff like that from the 60s, Manson murders, stuff like that. But then the funny thing about this bit is, I wonder what the like demographic of your listeners is, because, you know, there's the answering machine bit, but it doesn't really matter. And I still think it's sort of evergreen, because this could easily be a bit about like screen capping a text message and like showing your friends, like, what does that person mean when they say that? Like, that's definitely something that still happens. It just happens to be on a answering machine in 1992.
Very well said. People are listening at home, or wherever the hell you listen to this thing. Sex Dungeon. James just pointed out how you can just re-format jokes or re-reference jokes to like stay evergreen. I think that's a perfect way to put it, right? Talk about a screen cap. Let's break it down. I do like the introduction, and what a handsome group you are, which he makes himself very... I don't think he's pandering. I think it's more like he's become vulnerable. I think there's like a sincere, like, hey, you know, I'm happy.
Yeah, and then like for people, you can go to YouTube and find this whole set. It's just, if you look up Dana Gould One Night Stand, it's really interesting to look at the type of space he's performing in, because it is a huge like dinner theater situation, like a banquet hall. And you can hear people's glasses clinking and stuff. Even though they recorded a special, there's people getting food and things. So it's wild to look at how it's changed with the like production of a special.
Yeah. Thank you for mentioning that you can watch the visuals on YouTube. You don't have to be in the upper echelon of society and have HBO.
Yeah, some reason it is still out there on YouTube.
Then he says, you know, as you mentioned, I'm in a lot of pain, which is, I think, in an alt room or anywhere else that didn't have thousands of people or whatever the hell, and it would have played so well, but I don't think he got the reception that he deserved. I'm going to say deserved instead of intended, because I do think that was a really good It's a very good first line. He talks about being horribly, bleakly, depressed. So it's very clear what the sort of tone of this is. It's sort of introspective, and I'm going to tell you about myself. Then he does this thing where he kind of becomes more relatable to the audience, where he acts out being like waking up. He goes, oh fuck, I'm awake. Now what? Oh, the sun and the rest of the day? Pile it on. And it's, I think people can share in that sentiment, or if not, sort of sympathize with what's going on. And I think this is like alluding to like I would say centuries of existing as a human. So it's not only that he's like appealing to the zeitgeist of the time. It's, you know, you've had times, you know, you've had that quote that's been often misattributed to Camus, which is like, should I make a cup of coffee or kill myself?
Yeah, I think the opening of the clip, it could be a tweet in 2020. I see so many people getting that kind of thing getting shared all over the place, and tweets going viral with that, and like as a meme of that kind of sentiment. That's sort of the joke about Generation Z, is they're all deeply depressed, and then but they're comical about it. And yeah, like I said, it's evergreen.
I have pretty hard feelings about that. because I think it becomes transgressive in that point in time with Dana, with you know, Gen Z. I feel like it's just it kind of gets played out, and because it's mimetic, you know, the tweets and stuff like that. they're too replicated, and then they're too saturated. And anyway, that's just my opinion about that. Other very quick joke, right? After that, he said,
I felt like that definitely timestamps it or dates it, because how many people know what a mood ring is? I don't know how many years younger than me, you might just not know about what that was or is.
Yeah, and also, I do like that there is something about this, this mood ring gadget, and that like, maybe this isn't a well thought out thought, but it is in the moment. Yeah, you know, mood rings are supposed to tell other people how we felt. In a way, it's supposed to do the talking for us. Or it's also cute because it gets to guess whether or not it's accurate, right? It's like the same thing, but it still tells you, like, we weren't willing to tell other people how we really felt. The ring did. He talks about breaking up with someone. He does this. He has high energy, even though he's talking about these very sad things. He talks about breaking up with this woman. You know, he goes, "We'll call her Anne," which is a very cutesy move. I think it's a very like, it's a move that comics do make. You see it done. You know, I have this coworker who's always eating my yogurt. Let's call him Jim, right? So it's like, it puts up in the air whether that name
is actually, you don't know if they name. Is that really their name, or they left the possibility open that they made up a fake name, but it sort of doesn't matter. But then it is like an extra little bit you can, or an extra little tag you add onto it, of you get a like a little half laugh there.
Yeah, you get a half laugh because you're like, oh, but if it is their name, they can't actually, that's the taboo thing. You can't say someone's real name in front of this many people. And I like, okay, this is a detail that I think he did very well. To paint this picture, he says, you know, that the breakup happened just before Thanksgiving last year. So this is the holidays, but it's also like more than a year ago or something like that, right? And it gives you the impression of like how long this has been affecting him. I mean, it's still material that he wants to do. Like, I do a joke about this one woman that I dated, and it was about 2 years ago. But yeah, you get to see how like unintentionally this really brings a feeling to the joke.
Yeah, for me, it kind of, I don't know. By mentioning Thanksgiving, it sort of brings you into that it adds to that generalizable experience of seasonal depression. Holidays are harder for most people if they're missing someone or whatever. It kind of makes you think of there's that kind of gap in time of normal work or school or whatever you would be doing that you're going to be alone and notice the fact that you're alone.
Yeah. I think, yeah, you knocked it on the head there. And I do like this setup where he kind of becomes, I don't know if the word is heavy-handed, but he makes his description about like the first time in my life I felt like, you know, I don't want to embrace the pain. I want to move forward. Like that he really sees that as an option. He posits it to the crowd. And then he tells you, you know, it's almost like he's like in a crowd. Maybe you don't want to show that you don't want to show that you're the most mature person there, that you think about things calmly and reasonably. Right, you kind of here. You want to relate, so immediately he undercuts that. He sets it up. He knocks it down.
Don't you think it calls back to kind of a simpler time in that sort of experience where, you know, it's on an answering machine, so that's at home, and you have to be there to receive that message, and it's tied to physical space. But now that kind of unhealthy sort of circling back, like, why did they want to talk to me? What were they talking about? That is all in your pocket now. So I just think there, some things about this are evergreen. Some things are kind of a time capsule. I just wanted to just state that it's an interesting, the answering machine of it all is interesting to me.
Yeah. When he brings up that he received that message 4 days before Christmas, yeah, there is something about your home reflecting your internal space. Like this is like your own, like being at home reflects your thinking in a way. And that message, that physical recording represents a thought that kind of is blinking. If you say it, like, you know, the same way a recorder would, if you had a new message, it would blink a red light. So now we're in his set. Like when I saw him on stage, he chooses a point where the recorder is, and he's moving back and forth around it. He is manifesting with his physicality that, even though he's saying it out loud, but he's manifesting the thought by choosing a spot. That spot is where the recording is, and that recording is a thought that's like enveloping or like drowning out my house.
His space work and the act out is just amazing. And it's like I said, I don't know if you see as much of that kind of act out with him anymore. So at first I was kind of taken aback, but then I usually don't like that kind of, it's not that I don't like it, I don't gravitate towards, like, my favorite comics are not super physical like that. But then I realized that I was like, oh damn, he is like really good at this act out.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't touch on that point. Like fewer and fewer comics are doing act outs and getting silly on stage. I think one of the big ones that has been doing it recently is like Kevin Hart, but he's well along in his career, and he kind of stemmed from like the last couple of people, the last generation of comics who like moved around on stage. Now you have people walking up to the mic and just, you know, with slumped shoulders and there's less, I don't want to say showmanship, but there are fewer act outs. And if you are doing an act out, I think it's something pretty sophisticated, like Christina Catherine Martinez. I don't know if her space work, I think, is really good. Her movement is really calculated. So I think, there are fewer people who are doing what you're mentioning, which is using the stage in that way. But if you'd like, I will do more act outs in my act.
I don't know. It's like, it depends I have a quieter presentation just about life, and I appreciate then when someone can also be funny while doing that. And not everything has to be, you know, super like cocaine level energy all the time. There are certain comics that bring you in closer. They're going to invite you into their world, and you're still going to hang on every word, even though they're not, you know, running all over the stage. So diversity is always better for things, so we can have all types. So yeah, it was good to see that. I just think it's interesting to see some kind of progression, and I think it might just have to do with age. Like, he was very young at the time. He is, you know, 2 decades older now, 3 decades older almost. So it's different.
Well, also, I do like the idea that he is living out the situation. And, you know, we see, I don't know how to explain this. It's almost like compulsory that it has to come to life. Because, you know, later we see the final joke of this, like, 3-minute segment when he has, like, people analyzing the message. There's someone there with, like, I guess, like, a projector or a PowerPoint or whatever showing their findings. And it's, like, I can see why, well, other than him being super funny, why he wrote for The Simpsons. It's because he has to do it. He has to. I'm going off on this because when I do comedy, I feel the things. And, like, even as I'm talking right now, I'm very, like, gesture heavy when I talk. So I guess I'm just projecting onto him. Anyways. There's a moment when he plays the message for the first time. And he lets that moment breathe. He's like kind of nodding his head. But he's like letting everyone experience, like, by saying less, he's, you know, that cliche, he's saying more. Let's ruminate in this moment. I've just heard my ex wish me well or whatever for Thanksgiving. And I think that's a very smart move. You shouldn't be afraid of silence in comedy. And I think that's one of the first things you learn as an actor. It's like how to be comfortable.
Yeah, he kind of, when you say he lets it breathe, that's a good way to put it. And then the audience becomes curious. It's like, well, what did that mean? But also, what are you thinking about it? And there's a good 2 seconds that you really don't know as the viewer.
Yeah. What's going to happen next? And also because... I think, like, some of these jokes weren't hitting as well. I think one way to regain your composure and, like, to draw the audience back in, as you mentioned, is by just being quiet. I think Stephen Wright said this when he was on Marc Maron, or on Maron, or whatever you want to call it, where he said, one way to get the room's attention is by saying nothing. Like that, I do like... places. Well, I'm sorry, I'm trying to read my own writing. Well, that's that you can have a relationship and they can fall apart and you can keep in touch and not obsess. That's what I was mentioning earlier, where he can present maturity. Here's the option. And then he does the opposite, right? He obsesses. He acts out him playing the tape over and over again, different speeds. This repetition that he does gets him on the pause break, this little act out. This is like a very high energy, but also very...
It's just masterful with the voice work because he does his impression of the rewind and hits the same tone. It sounds like a recording. Yep. Like, he hits the same tone every time. It's just that probably had to take so much work on stage, and there had to be so many times that he fucked that up. Yeah, preparing that half hour set over years. I just imagine there had to be times that didn't work. And you mentioned like how different bits didn't hit. It's one of the times I laugh the hardest is he gets the applause break off of that, and it's still kind of fading away when he goes into the other bit of saying, like, people are analyzing it, like, oh, when her voice goes up there, what the hell does that mean? Or that must mean she's, I forget what he said, but just that doesn't get really anything. it's kind of lost in the applause break.
Oh, yeah, that's a good thing to mention. Yeah, he runs over his own thing, which, like, maybe he needed to keep going to keep
the... That's why I really like his style and how it progressed, is because he has a kind of frenetic energy that keeps moving on to different references and tags, even in conversation. Like, one, his podcast is one of the first podcasts I started listening to religiously, and I still listen to almost 10 years later. It's the Dana Gould Hour, but he is constantly making references, and I think that that carried over into his writing on The Simpsons, and the show became much more like that kind of cutaway humor of, it doesn't do it in the same way that Family Guy kind of egregiously does, which to actually cut to a completely different hypothetical situation. They'll just like cut to another part of the room in that scene in The Simpsons, and someone will say something almost non sequitur. And that annoyed people, I think, but I just am drawn to that. I like being, can you hit me with a bunch of different things that are going to push my laughter into kind of a wave of laughter?
Yeah. With reference, with like taking advantage of that web in our heads that connects things at like lightning speed, this thing to that thing to this thing. I will make a bold claim.
Uh-huh.
I'll never get pushback on this because I don't think enough people listen. But I think a comic is usually an alt comic. And an alt comic, I think I would say, usually reads and is worldly and not to summon bad vibes, but someone like Al Franken, very intelligent, great writer.
Mm-hmm.
You listen to Patton Oswalt, reads, great writer. Kyle Kinane, reads, great writer. He's one of these guys who understands things, and like, because he reads and consumes culture and society, you have so much more to draw from that I'm surprised some comics just don't. They stick to the same dick and ball joke. They stick to like whatever Philip DeFranco might have on his YouTube
with this,
his news, whatever.
Yeah, with this, you can see it in this set because it's less. Like we said, it's kind of funny that it seems like a very wholesome dinner theater type environment, but then he hits them with, and that's why I wonder if it translates to a newer audience. But then he mentions the Zapruder film, which is the film that's been overanalyzed to try to kind of figure out some conspiracy theory about how Kennedy was assassinated, is the filming of that assassination. He mentions that to then bring up his next bit, is which he saw at that time what was a recent film, which was JFK. But he's referencing then another Oliver Stone film, which was The Doors with Val Kilmer, and kind of combines those two. So that means almost nothing to... say someone who's 22 right now, if they haven't seen those films. But because I'm a nerd and I like older things, I know about both of those things and it works for me, but I don't know how it works for the rest of the people. But he then strings through the entire set. There's references to, again, the mental health and depression, but a bunch of 60s culture too. He does an impression of Don Knotts. There's a very current thing that he references, the Larry King show. And it brings in these, he talks about Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He like, the references are very highbrow, but they're done with very silly act outs and impressions. So I really feel like he can kind of be funny to anyone, but it might just be me. And it might be why he's always kind of been slotted as an alt comic.
Yeah. I think you're on point there. I quickly want to share this thing about reference and like how it can be limiting as a comic to consider. You know, you want to assume that your audience is intelligent, and I don't mean intelligent by intelligent. I mean competent. I mean by like intelligent. It's like that they know the references you do. You want to know that you want to feel like you can share as much as you can with them. But that's not always the case. It's very funny that we talk about this. This is the reason I bring it up. There's a Pruder film. I remember I was at UCB Franklin doing some doing an improv show, which I was grateful to be at, right? And the game of the scene was his grandmother, who had all these grandchildren who appreciated her gift. So it was kind of like a reference thing. It was like, oh, grandma, you know that I love cooking, so you got me this huge like pot. But it was funny or whatever. And I remember there was a moment where I wanted to say, hey, grandma, you know that I'm a cinephile, so you got me the original documentation from the Zapruder film. But I go, that's going to be alienating. I don't think that's going to hit. I just want to share that experience where I felt
I don't know though, like it's a big swing, but UCB Franklin, I think you would have if you would have taken that big swing, you would have got a couple knowing laughs, and a bunch of people would have thought you whiffed, but the few people that knew it would have really appreciated it. And I think you kind of asked like, what would you like to see as a fan in comedy? Is like, I'm always appreciative of people taking that kind of swing. But I mean, you're the one that has to deal with the awkward silence. So it's up to you.
Thanks for letting me share that. And then this bit rounds out with, he does an act out of like a team and analyzing the message that's on the tape. Now her voice goes up here on high to me, and that means she's sleeping with a big guy named Tony, which really, he like right as you're about to leave this realm of like swirling feelings of talking about an ex, right, you're almost gonna leave without the idea or like having to think about who they're with now. And just at the very end, he brings it up, this haunting feeling of having to realize, oh, she's with a different person. And it's this big guy named Tony, which I don't know what that means. Maybe he's alluding to the idea that maybe this guy can beat you up.
Yeah.
Or he's like a more brutish man, or he's the thing that you're not. And I think like for someone like Dana Gould, a big guy named Tony is like the low brow to his high brow.
Yeah, he's kind of conjuring some kind of brutish, like gym rat kind of guy, I think. I think people should watch the rest of the set. It's interesting to watch a comedy set from 1992, especially, and I think it is really funny. It also has like a weird kind of wholesomeness and sort of touching ending to it. Like he just kind of leaves on a very positive message. Dana Gould's great. I think he's a really good model for, one thing I want to bring up in particular was he's a really good model for apology. So, one thing where I was a fan, but then I really respected him was he was on a podcast once, this is probably 5 to 6 years ago, and he said something very transphobic and no one really called him out in the moment, but he had fans of that podcast kind of commenting saying, you know, that was fucked up. And then rather than just issue like a half-ass apology or whatever, he addressed it thoroughly. He had a trans performer reached out to him and said, I'll come on your show and I'll talk to you about why what you did was messed up. He had it on his own podcast, had that segment and talked about that. I've heard him bring it up much later on the same podcast and say, like, one time I did this, I realized I was wrong. You know, he rather like some people kind of skip over their moment or they do the bare minimum to get through their kind of scandal on social media. But yeah, I didn't get the sense that he's very interested in that kind of superficial thing. He realized like, this is how I relate to the world. This is a marginalized group and I can change the way I talk about and do material and thinking about that group. And I think he probably turned into a bit too, to like look at the, he keeps drawing attention to the fact like I messed up in this way and you can learn from it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. He seems like a thoughtful and level-headed guy. And I do also hope that one day he maybe says wetback on his
to go on the Dana podcast, Gould Hour.
Or I have an opportunity to maybe go and talk to him about it. Yeah. and with that, I think we're going to wrap up the episode. I really appreciate you coming on. I am a fan of Don't Sit in the Front. Also, I think it's a
Thank
great
you.
Title for a comedy podcast.
Yeah.
In fact, I might offer to buy it from you at some point. And I think you provided a lot of insight. I think people will be happy to hear what you have to say. So if you don't, you can rest assured tonight. Please listen to Don't Sit in Front. Give it a listen. Maybe even leave a review. I will be on there in a few weeks.
Thank you so much. I'm glad you listened and we kind of connected. And I think we can kind of we probably share listeners who are this interested in this in-depth analysis of stand-up. So if someone's still listening to this point, you should definitely come and check out Don't Sit in the Front, my podcast.
Or even
it's don't sit in the front on Instagram. It's don't_sit on Twitter, but Twitter kind of eludes me. I'm still not quite sure what I want to do with that, but Instagram is the best place to reach me and then see when episodes come out every Friday, at least for the foreseeable future. Joe's episode is going to be the last one to come out before the election. So it might be the last of that kind of unsure vibe. So we'll see what happens, but yeah, check out Joe's episode when it comes out in a few weeks.
Okay.
Great.
James, I think we killed that frog.